Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Insects and the world we humans share with them is the topic of this edition of Radio Curious. Our guest is anthropologist Hugh Raffles, the author of Insectopedia, an exploration of some of the most beautiful creatures in the world, or, depending on one's personal and perhaps cultural perspective, some of the most scary or ugly creatures in the world. I spoke with Hugh Raffles by phone from his home in New York City on March 22, 2010, and began our conversation by asking him, "What is an insect?" Hugh Raffles, welcome to Radio Curious.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I think we should begin with the question, what is an insect?
That's a great question. In biological terms, or, you know, some classification, insect is a six-legged animal with a segmented body in three sections, I think. I'm not an entomologist, so I'm not great at this. But I think that's the basic definition, either winged or wingless.
So you're talking to us from the perspective of an anthropologist.
Yes.
So what is it that an anthropologist finds curious about the world of insects?
You know, for me, I've been a lot of research in the last few years by anthropologists and other social scientists who've been looking at the relationships between people and animals. And my first research was in the Amazon, at the mouth of the Amazon in a village. And when I was there, I never really thought very much about nature very much before, although I did live in California for a while, but I'm really a city person. I just hadn't really thought very much about nature. But living in the Amazon, I started to, you know, I really pay attention to it in ways that I hadn't done before. When I came back to the U.S., and there was started to be some of this interest in this relationship between people and animals, I also got interested in it as well and started thinking about it. A lot of people were writing about their relationships with pets, which I agree is really interesting, or else about primates. But I started thinking about other kinds of animals that were getting less attention, but also that were interesting because they were less human, I suppose.
And also creatures with which we as humans don't interact like we would with pets. And to some extent, Jane Goodall comes to mind with the interaction with primates.
You know, I think all this work is really very interesting. We've learned an awful lot from it, but insects seem so completely different. We can't really recognize ourselves in them so easily. They don't have faces or recognizable faces. They don't seem to respond to us in any way. They seem completely indifferent to us. And yet people have these very intense reactions to them, either fear or repulsion, or, you know, some people feel real attraction to them or to some insects. You know, it's as if there's good insects and bad insects.
Well, let's start, Hugh Raffles, with your reaction to insects.
Now I feel very differently about them. At first, I didn't know very much about them, which is a large reason, actually, for why I got interested in writing the book. And now I know a lot more, at least, about the insects that I've written about. I'm really fascinated by them now. I'm sort of amazed by them. It's the kind of thing that the more you find out, the more you realize how much there is to know, and also how little we know. I mean, how much even really people who devote their lives to studying them know. They're really an unknown part of the planet, even though there's so many of them and they're so important in our lives as well.
You've just set out three categories for us. One, what you've learned. Another, how much there is to know. And the third, how little we know. Choose one and start.
Well, I like the how little we know, actually. That's the part of it that really fascinated me with the book. And maybe it seems strange to spend so long studying something and then just be taken up by how little we know. One of the things that really fascinated me about this is starting to think about how different beings occupy completely different worlds. You know, we live in this world that we think of as basically as the world. It's, you know, it has an objective reality to it. Other animals, and I think insects are a great example of this because they're so different from us. They have such different senses that they live in a world that is completely different from ours. You know, they have a very different sense of time, very different sense of space. You know, they see completely differently, or they might not really see very much at all, but they might be extremely sensitive to vibration or to touch or to, and yet we have almost no way of accessing what that reality is like. I mean, it's hard enough to get inside the mind of another person, but we have no real notion of the ways in which insects experience the world or how they how they communicate with each other, if they communicate with each other, what they feel, how they feel, any of these kinds of things. So there are people who study these things and who develop models of what this might be like.
So Hugh Raffles, author of Insectopedia, can you tell us the knowledge that you've picked up from your point of view as an anthropologist about the insects? And maybe we should begin with which insects have you carefully monitored?
Well, a lot more crickets ended up in this book than I expected. So I spent time with people who train crickets to fight in China and learned quite a lot about crickets there. Crickets came into it from cricket sound because, of course, you know, they make these beautiful sounds. Crickets also came into it in Florence in Italy, where there used to be a festival that celebrated crickets every spring. The festival actually still exists, but there's no crickets in it anymore, at least no live crickets anymore, because there's a campaign by Animal Rights Campaign to stop the sale of live crickets, or the capture and sale of live crickets. Crickets no longer sold in the festival, and as a result, the festival has pretty much died. It's just turned into pretty much like a market.
You mentioned Chinese crickets. Tell us about them.
There's really a pretty long-standing tradition, I suppose, of people training and fighting crickets in China. And it's also been tied up with a culture of gambling. The people who train them are extremely skilled and sophisticated at doing that. And they've built up over time a very, very detailed classification system of different crickets, ways of categorizing crickets and of judging their abilities. They've also developed very detailed ways of caring for crickets and feeding them, curing them, you know, looking after them if they get sick, this sort of thing. It's really very developed, let's say, leisure activity or something like that, but it's maybe more than a leisure activity because it's also, as I said, tied in with gambling. And so for many people, it's an important part of that, an important economic activity as well.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're talking with Hugh Raffles, the author of Insectopedia. You are listening to Radio Curious, and I'm Barry Vogel. Hugh, would you like to tell us your thoughts about public radio?
Well, Barry, I'm an avid listener to public radio, and here in New York City I listen to WNYC, but when I lived out in California a few years ago, I used to listen to public radio all the time in the Bay Area and down in Santa Cruz. And at that time I would listen to Radio Curious when I could, and always felt how lucky we were to have Radio Curious out there in the Bay Area. So it's a real pleasure to be able to speak on its behalf right now. And I guess one thing that I'd like to say to anybody listening is that, you know, as somebody who writes about insects, I think it's very important that we don't think of ourselves, when it comes to pledge drive with public radio, we don't think of ourselves as parasitic wasps freeloading on the station and letting other people pay for us. But instead, we get like those busy bees and do our own work and support the station ourselves, because we know everything that it does for us and how important it is to have it in our lives. So please call 895-2233 or 1-800-298-1296.
Hugh, how does one train a cricket?
First, you select a good cricket. So you really have to know what you're doing in order to choose one. And I have to say that for me, the differences were really, really impossible to identify, even when people were pointing them out to me.
What sort of things did they identify choose a trainable cricket?
Well, it's extremely detailed. So people, in the first place, people choose from three different colors of crickets, and or at least three. It depends on, you know, different people have different schemes, but at least three different colors. And it was even very hard at that level of difference for me to recognize. But then it gets down to the shape of the antennae, the translucence of the exoskeleton, the strength of the jaws, almost any characteristic you can think of, people will call on, and people will be able to debate. So it's really, I don't know, I mean, I suppose people who are really knowledgeable about, say, horses and horse racing would be able to also talk in tremendous detail about the differences between particular horses. But people can really do that with crickets as well. And there's an enormous number of different variables, you know, physical variables. But then the most important thing is what people call fighting spirit the cricket has. So once it actually goes into an arena, how it's going to perform. But so what people are doing by looking at these other characteristics, you know, these physical things, is trying to assess what its fighting spirit is going to be like, and how it's going to actually fight when it's going to get into the ring, if it's going to be courageous and strong and all these kinds of things.
Well, most creatures in the animal and insect world fight to be in a better position to mate and to reproduce their own kind. Is this cricket match that you're speaking of, and it's clear that it's not in the British term of a cricket match, does that devolve or evolve, whichever the direction may be, from the mating process?
Well, people say that in their habitat, these kinds of crickets are very territorial. They do, you know, control their territory, and they'll fight other crickets that come into their territory. What people who are training them are doing is channeling that behavior into this much more controlled environment. But people, they really train them. They work with these little pieces of grass, these little sticks of grass, and they'll touch the cricket in different places to get it to do different things. So they'll also talk to it. People who are really good at this can give crickets verbal commands, and the crickets will respond to the verbal commands. I mean, they'll tell them, you know, turn left, turn right, that kind of thing. And they'll use the grass at the same time, but then the cricket will respond to that. It's sort of amazing to see.
Are the random responses rewarded with something that the cricket likes, like food?
No, not really.
In the training process?
Not that I've seen, no. There's not a direct sort of, you know, this behavior, it's a like behavior reward thing as people do with dogs, say, no. But people do those exercises with the crickets to make them limber, you know, to make them, more agile, I suppose.
So if you tell a cricket to turn right, how does the cricket know that that's what you want it to do?
I don't know. You tell me. I don't know. It's sort of an amazing thing.
But you've seen it done.
Yeah. I only saw one person do it, but I assume other people can do it too. This person was, you know, somebody who'd been training crickets for 30, 40 years, so was particularly skilled.
Well, let's leave crickets behind and move on to your chapter about my nightmares. Tell us about the nightmares that you have. Are they related to insects?
Well, I think these are nightmares that at some level many people have. There's just what I was trying to get across in that chapter was just the intensity of our anxieties about insects. And they come in so many different forms. You know, there's the nightmare of there being too many of them and they're overrunning us. And then there's the nightmare of them being, you know, giants and us having to face them. I mean, all the things which we've seen again and again in popular culture, and the nightmare of them getting into your face or getting into your hair or getting into your mouth, something like that. A lot of these things are about them getting, you know, too close to our bodies and even getting inside our bodies.
Do you find that these nightmares are different among different cultures, perhaps even on different continents?
You know, it's very possible, but that's not something that I ever talk to people about. But it is very possible, isn't it? People have very different relationships with insects in different places. And as you know, in the book, I traveled quite a lot to write this book. And that was one of the things that was, for me, most enjoyable about doing the book. And people have different kinds of connections in different places. So one of the chapters is about locusts in Niger. And there, the animals that people call locusts are, you know, in the grasshopper family. Well, in fact, the terminology it's hard to pin down exactly, but some of the words that people use for locusts are the same as they use for other kinds of grasshoppers. And so the same kinds of animals are both a important food, more like a luxury food, really, but it's an important food. And they're also the animals that cause destruction of crops. So I think the real nightmares that people have about locusts there and across the Sahel are about swarms invading and destroying their crops. But at the same time, you know, when locusts come, sometimes they also offer food and the possibility of plenty. as there is here, I think, there's also a lot of ambivalence about them.
The food that they offer is the locusts themselves that people could eat.
That's right, yeah. People boil them, and then they fry them. And they're this very crunchy, you know, crunchy snack food. And, you know, very much, you know, it's sort of almost like a festival food, but like luxury food kinds of things that we'd eat at parties or something like that.
From an anthropological perspective, how do you integrate the chapter that you have on Jewish people into the story of insects?
Well, I think that there's quite a common, I don't know what the word would be, procedure, I suppose, that we see happening, in which people get, let's say, turned into animals of various kinds, either compared to animals, but the comparison goes further than just being a straight comparison. It becomes so powerful that people actually get turned into or get made into this different being. And the example that I write about in the book is about Jews in Nazi Germany. But you can also think about similar kinds of things happened to the Tutsis in Rwanda, where 4 weeks before the genocide in 1994, the Hutu Power Radio was describing them as cockroaches and calling on people to eradicate cockroaches. And the effect of that really was to make Tutsis into a different kind of being, and one that you could just kill in the same way that you could kill cockroaches, so that you could just eradicate them as vermin. And the Nazis did something similar to Jews. They were constantly being compared to vermin in order to, not just to justify, but to enable, I think, the kinds of things that were done to them. And to create them just to sort of, I think in both cases, it's to push people out of the category of humanity into another category. And if it's a category of animals that get, you know, that you're able to eradicate and not treat as lives worth living, then you can do the same to the people who become those animals.
And then you follow the chapter on Jews with a chapter on Kafka.
Yeah, I do. And I wanted to write something about Kafka, but as you can see, it's not really about Kafka. It's more about Metamorphosis, which is, you know, just this extraordinary phenomenon that these animals are one thing, and then they completely dissolve and reform themselves as something else. And it really seemed to raise that question for me, as if, you know, what's the continuity? What is it that goes from the first thing into the second thing? You know, what's preserved from the caterpillar into, say, the butterfly? What way is that the same? Is the same animal? And when I was doing that research, it was really interesting because I found out that there are almost no field guides to caterpillars. There's really very little attention on them. So there's tons and tons of stuff about butterflies, as you know, right? But there's I think the first field guide to caterpillars only came out last year or the year before. But I don't know. It's almost like they're just not taken seriously, because they're regarded as the first stage of the final thing, and it's the final thing that is the real thing or something. It's what gets the count.
Well, Hugh, it seems like many of the questions that I'm asking you, you respond with, there's a great unknown here in insects. And one of the great unknowns that I think you address is the effect of radioactivity on insects. And I'm wondering if in your chapter on Chernobyl and the fallout, the radioactive fallout that resulted from that disaster, and the effects on insects, do you see that as a foretelling of the effects on life in general?
Yes, and I think the woman who I write about, who's a Swiss artist who's been collecting tiny little insects around nuclear power stations, mostly in Switzerland, for the last 30 years, and has been finding these very high levels of deformities amongst them, also thinks that. And, you know, especially at the moment where there's now this big push, even from the Obama administration, to bring back nuclear power as a green technology, as a response to global warming. But it's really something that we need to really reopen that debate again and be very cautious before going down that road. Well, you know, because she's found these levels of deformity, she actually ties that to an argument that many people are making about low level radioactivity, and arguing that instead of the conventional way of measuring radioactivity, which is that it has to pass the threshold before it becomes, radioactivity has to pass a certain threshold, quite a high threshold, before it becomes a danger, so that any emissions that are below that level are not dangerous. They argue that the effect of radiation is more dependent on the body that it's hitting, or that the radionuclides are hitting, than it is on the amount of radiation itself. They point out that the thresholds that are established by the international regulatory agencies were drawn from studies of the atomic bombs over Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And this is, you know, unreliable for several reasons, partly because it was such an enormous amount of radiation in a very small space.
And it doesn't address the low-level radiation to which so many of us are exposed to in cell phones, for example.
Exactly. But Cornelia Hasse-Honegger, who's been doing this work now for a long time, has been doing it around Swiss power stations, which have been regarded as being the cleanest power stations of all. And what she's found is really, really, I think, quite disturbing and quite important.
And what is it that she has found?
She's just found these very high levels of deformities amongst insects. She has exhibitions where she does these, really what are portraits of these deformed insects. And they're very beautiful, very, very, she's really quite a remarkable painter. And some of them are very large format and very, very striking. Very striking, very effective.
When we talk about deformities, I think that indicates a mutation. My understanding of evolution is that we have come to be the way we in our species are by a variety of mutations over millions of years that have been to some extent beneficial and to some extent non-beneficial. So what I'm curious about, if you know, is are there mutations from radioactivity that would present a beneficial mutation, or are we just yearning for the status quo?
You know, I think it's not clear that these kinds of mutations are inherited. And I don't think Cornelia makes any claims that they are. I think she just says that this is what happens to the animals when they're exposed to this radiation. But the kinds of things that she's seeing are really things that don't seem to be beneficial at all. They're like misshapen wings and misshapen body parts, missing limbs, missing antennae. These kinds of things.
But we don't know if those that were born that way were exposed to the radiation during their gestational period, mm-hmm. or their ancestors and any number of generations back were exposed.
No, the only way you could tell that, and you know, she does make this case, would be to have some kind of baseline data from which you could say this is a much greater level. You're seeing a much higher level of these kinds of deformities in these locations that are closer or downwind from these power stations than you are doing in other places. So she creates these maps that show in relation to wind direction where you find these clusters of deformities. And they seem to, from what I can tell anyway, they certainly seem to indicate quite strongly that where animals are being exposed to radionuclides that are coming, you know, either from a wind pattern or just from proximity, then they're suffering from much higher levels of deformity than animals that are in other places and are not being affected.
Well, Hugh Raffles, author of Insectopedia, I thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I have some questions about you.
Okay.
And one of them is, what would you like to do with the remainder of your one precious life?
Such a great question. I have to say, I really enjoy what I am doing. So I would just like the chance to keep doing it, but in maybe in some different ways. But, you know, to be able to write is very important to me, to be able to meet really, really interesting people and to be able to travel. I feel like I'm on the Miss World pageant, right? To meet interesting people, to travel, and really just to keep doing what I'm doing. I feel very, very fortunate in constantly being able to meet interesting people and just explore topics and questions that to me are very, very fascinating.
In doing that, can you tell us about an aha or eureka moment that's occurred to you?
There's been a lot, actually, with the Insight book. That's what been one of the great things about writing it. One of them, which actually appeared in the first chapter of the book, I found out from reading that the sky around us is, particularly during the daytime and during good weather, is full of insects. Maybe up to 15,000 feet would be about the highest level. They're all going somewhere, and they seem to be going somewhere deliberately. They might not know exactly where they're going, but they've taken off because they want to go somewhere, and they have control over, more or less control over where they're landing. And some of them are animals, that insects that just can't fly at all, but they've positioned themselves and got themselves into the air and then get carried along by the convection currents. So there's this other world of travel going on around us. It's completely invisible to us because, you know, they're tiny, tiny little things, but they're just doing this thing going around the planet above us. And that was a pretty amazing thing to me. And it was one aspect of this question that just kept coming up again and again in writing this book, which was the feeling that there is so much going on in the world that we really are not aware of, but that we can just start to get a sense of. Not just that it can be so interesting, but there's just so many possibilities for the ways in which it can be different.
And finally, can you tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately?
Actually, it was two books by the same author. They were novels by Roberto Bolaño, novel The Savage Detectives in 2666. They were very hyped. Despite that, they were really fantastic novels. Just amazing in their scope and ambition, and his willingness to take risks, both in the narrative and in his topics. And as much as anything, just because they're very inspiring. You know, sometimes you read things, they have this sort of freedom about them that makes you feel that, so much is possible.
Kind of like Encyclopedia.
Well, I like to think so, yeah.
Well, Hugh Raffles, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
Well, Barry, thank you very much indeed for having me. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Hugh Raffles is the author of Encyclopedia. The books that he recommends are both written by Roberto Bagnallo. First is The Savage Detectives, and second is 2666. This interview with Hugh Raffles was recorded on March 22, 2010, by phone from his home in New York City. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious are available on our website, www.radiocurious.org. You can also subscribe to the Radio Curious podcast by clicking on our website. Our programs are also available in CD format. To get a copy, visit our website, radiocurious.org, for further details. And we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and do enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org, and the phone number is 707-462-6541. Our programs are recorded in our studios in Ukiah, California. Hannah Bird heads our post-production staff. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for joining us.